Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth. And we've just heard from Boris Johnson, where he unveiled his social care plan and general NHS funding strategy to MPs. James, there's been lots of huff and puff in recent days from MPs, some publicly, and many ministers anonymously about how much they oppose Boris Johnson's plan. But what did the Prime Minister lay out today, and what was the initial response?
So I think what Number 10 will be most relieved about is how little Tory opposition there was to the plan. You know, Rob Halfen talked about mitigations for lower paid workers in terms of paying this national insurance increase. Damien Green raised a very pertinent question, which is, you know, if you're going to, how do you ensure that the NHS doesn't swallow up all this money? This money is initially meant to go for the NHS backlog and then move to social care. You know, his point, which is a very fair one, is how do you ensure that that actually happens? But I think that the Tory rebellion, which is, you know, which was quite evident in the weekend papers, you know, I think that definitely there was less of that today. It would be a big surprise based on today in the chamber if there was a sizable Tory rebellion on this. I think you saw Boris Johnson trying to frame this as he's having to break his manifesto promise because of the backlogs in the NHS caused by COVID. He said, you know, look, I don't break my manifesto promise lightly, but a global pandemic wasn't in anyone's manifesto. He was trying to argue that if he didn't, you know, take this action, then the waiting list could rise to 30 million, he claimed. You know, that would be one in four people in England. And I think that this is the way he is trying to frame it. He is trying to use the public's affection for the NHS to justify the tax rise. I mean, the political danger for him is that he falls between two stools, is that he has raised taxes, he has broken a manifesto promise, but they don't get a clear grip on the NHS waiting list. And so you end up with people feeling that they've paid more tax, but they haven't got that much back in return for it. I mean, that is the political risk. And I mean, and then that is why this remains a gamble.
And James, do you think the specific details of the policy have helped to reduce the scale of rebellion, in the sense that one of the issues we've had in recent weeks is that there hasn't been much reach out to MPs? Cabinet only shown the plan this morning. Was it the fact that actually the plan went up close is less bad than as reported?
I don't think it's that so much. I think it's the kind of reality that it's happening. And if you want to oppose it now, you're going to have to vote against the government. And to vote against the government on tax and spend is about as fundamental as it gets. I also think that one of the things that the problems that this plan has suffered from is a kind of lack of preparation. And I think there is an unfairness in the system that if you get cancer, the costs of your care are largely covered. If you get Alzheimer's, they're largely not. And so I think that resonates with people. And I think, you know, the decision, for example, to also increase the tax on dividend income and to extend national insurance to working age pensioners, I think all of those slightly offset some of the claims of generational unfairness. And obviously, if you see the triple lock, as we expect it to, being suspended for a year, I mean, that's another thing that helps on that point of the generational fairness point. I also think he is helped by the fact that Keir Starmer had one good question in his response, which is, you know, can you guarantee that this will clear the backlog? Now, Boris Johnson can't do that because no one knows how big the backlog is. But I thought Keir Starmer's response is held back by the fact that he's not against extra money for the NHS, but he can't say how he would fund it. And that, I think, is a problem for Labour, because they are against this tax rise, but they are for the money. So what is their answer?
Yeah, and there were some interesting lines today. I think we can hear what Keir Starmer accused the party of.
Mr. Speaker, read my lips. The Tories can never again claim to be the party of low tax. Yeah.
And we can hear what Boris Johnson now says the Tory party is a party of.
This is the government that gets on and deals with the people's priorities. This is the government that tackles social care. And indeed, this is the party of the NHS. Yeah.
So, James, you can see what Keir Starmer's trying to do there. And you can see how Boris Johnson is branding the Tories after you had Nadeem Zahori say at the weekend that the Tories are now the party of fair tax. Do you think that this is actually going to be quite a potent line for the Tories? The fact that normally Labour would attack the Tories on the NHS. Do you think the fact that they are putting this funding in, it means that we're going to see quite a different attack lines at the next election?
Look, I think the Tory decision to put this money into the NHS is a sign that they have decided that the risk of Labour being able to say, you can't trust the Tories with the NHS, look, we've got, you know, 10 million people on the waiting list, was a bigger political risk than the charge that they have broken their manifesto promise not to raise taxes. I think, look, where Boris Johnson has been disingenuous is that, you know, the promise in the manifesto that they weren't going to raise taxes and also that no one would have to sell their home to pay for the cost of social care, those two promises were always incompatible. It was always very hard to see how you could introduce, if not impossible, to see how you could introduce a reform which meant that people didn't have to sell their home to pay for care, but which didn't involve raising taxes to fund that.
And James, the government plans to push ahead with a vote on this issue. We're expecting that tomorrow. Do we expect this to now pass fairly easily despite all the noise at the weekend?
A kind of savvy Tory MP said to me, just watch how many people go on the record in the chamber and stand up and tell the Prime Minister they think he's wrong, and that'll give you an idea of the size of the rebellion. The fact there was so little hostility from the Tory benches suggests that this rebellion is not going to be of any... It would be very surprising if this rebellion was of any great size.
And another factor in this, when we're trying to predict how some might respond, the fact that you have had multiple cabinet ministers briefing that they're unhappy but not putting their name to it, is this dangling threat of a reshuffle, rumours that it could be on Thursday. That's very much, I think, no one really wants to say either way if they think that's definitely going to happen or not happen. But do you think that has impacted how A, ministers, but B, ambitious MPs are responding to this policy?
I think the dangling of a reshuffle carrot or stick, or whichever way you want to see it,
I think we'll go stick.
It's pretty transparent, right? I'm not saying that means the reshuffle is definitely not happening. I think it is, but it's quite clear they want to put this thought in people's minds. I think on the cabinet, there is a long term thing that I think Prime Minister's cabinet government has eroded progressively over time. You know, an erosion that started really under Thatcher, accelerated under Blair, and then accelerated yet further during the COVID crisis. And I think that where Prime Ministers should be careful is it is collective responsibility requires decisions to be collectively made. I don't think very many ministers feel that they were involved in the collective decision-making process on this. And the danger that any Prime Minister runs with this is that when things go wrong, I don't think that many cabinet ministers feel that they are kind of, you know, bound to this policy. If this policy was starts to land very badly, if it starts to unravel, I don't think there'll be any shortage of cabinet ministers willing to speak, admittedly off the record, about, you know, how this was always going to be a disaster. They knew the problems with it. And I think that this is the challenge for the government, which is, you know, you could have a very choppy autumn. And I think that having a cabinet meeting the morning that you're going to announce something to the Commons at lunchtime, you know, when you've never discussed the issue really properly in cabinet before, I think that is a risky strategy.
And speaking of cabinet, a former cabinet minister appeared to make their return to the Commons today in the form of Matt Hancock, former health secretary. What did he have to say, James?
So he had two contributions today, which I think is a sign that he clearly feels that, you know, he wants to say that he's back. In Treasury questions, he got up to ask a very supportive question. And then in the health and social care statement, he got up to ask a question talking about the importance of integrating health and social care. One of Boris Johnson's rationales for this move in his statement was that, you know, that there are lots of people who are in NHS hospitals who would be better off being in care settings. And so finding a solution to social care is necessary to relieve some of the pressure on the NHS. And I think what that shows is that, you know, Matt Hancock clearly feels he's done with his period of, you know, of keeping a low profile. He is going to try and become a more kind of active political player. I think even even Matt Hancock, who is known as an optimist, couldn't think that this week's reshuffle, if there was to be one, would be too soon. Yeah. But I think it is a clear statement that he intends to kind of resume his political career, but he isn't planning to kind of keep a low profile before skulking away from the House of Commons at the next election.
And finally, James, you've spoken about some of the risks of this policy if it doesn't address what it is aimed to do. One of the things the Treasury has been worried about, along with some Tory MPs, is that the funding initially will go towards a backlog and then it moves to social care. And I've heard several people make the case, some even supportive of Boris Johnson, that their concern is, in what world do you get to a point where in a couple of years' time the NHS doesn't say it needs that extra funding to stay in place? Now, it seems as though Rishi Sunak has won something of a pledge in the sense that it will be legally binding. But is that enough reassurance?
I mean, this is the question that Damien Green asked, and I think it is a very perceptive question. I'm reminded of Henry VII had something called Morton's Fork, named after one of his tax officials. And he used to turn up at a nobleman's house, and if there was a great feast and entertaining, he would say, "Look how lavishly you live. You can obviously afford to give the king more money." But if a nobleman was wise to this and he turned up and he was served, you know, mutton stew and there was no great entertainment, he would say, "Ah, look at your size of your land holdings. You live so frugally. So you must have great savings that you can give to the king." And I think the danger for the government is you can see a similar NHS-run version of this argument in 3 years' time. If in 3 years' time they have managed to clear the backlog using this money, or at the very least get on top of it, they'll say, "Look how much better the NHS runs with this extra cash. Why would you want to take it away from us? Why would you want to cut the amount of money going to the NHS?" By contrast, if the backlog hasn't been cleared and we've still got a big waiting list, you know, 5 million plus, you know, saying, "Look, you can't take the money away from us now because this was money given to us to help clear the backlog and we haven't yet cleared the backlog." I mean, this is the biggest potential problem with this policy, which is how do you ensure that the money doesn't just get swallowed up by the NHS? How do you ensure it actually goes to social care to fund this floor and this cap that Boris Johnson is so keen to introduce?
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.